Okay, we're back. I think we're at episode 343, if I'm not mistaken. Well, whatever episode, we are back. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well. First, we had the passing of O.J. Simpson this week.
Yes, we did.
O.J. Simpson, he was 76. Of course, O.J. Simpson, perhaps more infamous than famous, because of the trial of the century, 1995, the 1994, the June 1994. 94 murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, the waiter at their house in Brentwood, an exclusive neighborhood. I remember when this occurred. I heard about it. I was painting a house at the time, a very hot day. I was on a ladder. I was listening to talk radio. I was like, what? And of course, there was the infamous Bronco, Ford Bronco ride. That was my first exposure to like surreal news. I went to go visit my brother on a hot evening. We were just watching TV on a Friday night. We were talking and we were watching this go down, and we were just suddenly amazed at how absurd it all seemed. O.J. Simpson, sort of this, star athlete, celebrity, him with a gun in the back of the Bronco, A.C. Cowling, a former NFL player, driving, former friend of his. He finally surrenders himself. At the time, it appeared that there was damning evidence of his guilt. A narrative was spun of a jealous husband, violent man. Although there wasn't much record of violence in his past, he was, of course, we all know, eventually acquitted. And this divided the nation. Many Americans saw it as his defense team sort of using the race issue to cover it up, to muddy the water, so to speak, for his obvious guilt. The idea, they asked Mark Furman, have you ever said nigger? And he lied on the stand. He did say that word, actually. This is back when actually you could say that word in context. Hey, you say that word, now you have to say the N-word, right? So everyone thinks of it, they don't say it. That's all part of the psyop there. Just a word, not a nice word, but it is a word. And so Mark Furman was sort of cross-examined and shown to be have racial, I guess, racist tendencies, if you will. And maybe you think that, and he was acquitted. Many Americans thought it was a Bronx trial type thing where they were acquitted because of the racial issue, a reaction to Rodney King. The media spun that narrative that this was sort of acknowledgement of corruption of law enforcement in Los Angeles. Of course, the idea of O.J. Simpson being a victim of racism is kind of funny. He lived in Brentwood, was worth like $15 million, and normally thought O.J. Simpson as being particularly black. He was O.J. Simpson, the Hertz rent-a-car guy, the guy in The Naked Gun, and Roots, and some of the other movies. He did a lot of like movies. Became sort of a lot of athletes become movie and actors after their career ends. But nevertheless, that was the angle the defense team took, and sort of drawing into question the motivations and the integrity of the police and of the prosecution. And evidently, it worked. So basically you had this divide in the country where you had whites thinking that he had got off for murder, blacks either thinking he justly got off or it didn't matter. That's what really enraged a lot of whites. White people thought that blacks didn't care that he was a murderer, the fact that he was black, and there's some justification for that because there is some sentiment that in the black community regarding that. I mean, they'd rather have less people in jail than deal with the crime problem. But that kind of confuses the issue, that this focus on the trial itself. From what I understand, is the acquittal came because there's cause for reasonable doubt, because it came out in the trial that evidence had been planted. This had to do with the blood sample that had EDTA, which is a preservative. It was in the blood that was supposedly pulled from the crime scene, and it had that preservative in it, suggested that it was taken and then taken to a lab, then taken out of the lab, and then applied at the crime scene. The planting of evidence and other questions regarding a bloody sock. Some people testified that it had been not worn, it was pressed on a blood stain. There's problems with the timeline, meaning that phone record phone calls were apparently made, although the phone records were never manifested, which is suspect to me, meaning that it was a question of when this actually occurred. And OJ never had a good alibi, but there are witnesses that he was very calm, and according to the official timeline, I think within a half hour, he would have had to clean up all the blood because he nearly decapitated Nicole Brown Simpson and cut the throat of Ron Goldman, allegedly, R raced home, cleaned up, and caught a red eye to Chicago. And no one noticed anything was odd about him, nor did they notice any damage to his body. He had been photographed, stripped down to his underwear. There was no trauma to his body. He had supposedly overpowered two younger adults, Ron Golden being a very muscular young man, killed them both, and did that without any sustaining any trauma to his body. And so there was that. There was the cut on the finger, which he claimed he cut himself in a glass, that he broke a glass when he found out that the murder had occurred. The problem with the cut on the finger was the infamous gloves that he supposedly worn to commit the crime had no tear in them. So there, that's an inconsistency there in that, and that problem. So there's problems with timelines and these sort of things. There's also, now this is a positive, there's some suggestion, the defense team originally claimed and suggested that the, Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson were victims of some sort of drug burn. There was a lot of cocaine dealing in the area, particularly in restaurants and waiters and these things. And Ron Goldman himself apparently had two or three friends, I think, that had been murdered within a year of his murder, meaning a year before and a year after, all related to drugs. And there is some evidence that Ron Goldman was a confidential informant. And then there's Fred Goldman, who married a woman who'd been married to a drug dealer. So there's a lot there. And a lot of people don't remember that or never were aware of this. But when I found out about this stuff, I thought there was at least grounds for his acquittal based just merely on the fact that evidence, likely evidence had been planted. And then the other narratives, meaning that there's a lot going on in LA in drug dealing. O.J. Simpson actually had been a subject of a counter-narcotics investigation in the 1970s, dealing drugs to athletes. That was very common in Major League Baseball and football, where athletes were set up to deal drugs, to basically sell drugs to other athletes, and they'd use their celebrity status as cover. And he was the subject of an investigation. A.C. Cowlings, his friend, the guy who drove him on the highway there. Remember the getaway going 25 miles an hour? But anyway, yeah. He panicked or something. I mean, again, I don't know. Obviously, he wasn't a good man, but I wouldn't say he was a saint, but there's some grounds to question his guilt. A.C. Cowlings was reputed to be either a bodyguard to a drug dealer. So it's very convoluted. And so when people are so sure that he's guilty, I just suspect they should probably take a step back and maybe reconsider that and not be so sure about it.
Yeah, I agree. I've when that happened, I was convinced he was guilty, and shocked I wasn't shocked, but I thought that the trial, which I believe was all black, but I'm not, maybe there was two Latinos on it. My memory's not clear on that, but it was primarily black, jurors. And so when he was acquitted, I just thought it was a race-based decision. But then, it's funny because the real sort of illogicalness of the prosecution's case wasn't really presented either in the news or, you know, by the prosecutors themselves during the trial, or even by the defense. I mean,
yeah, it was Lance Ito and the prosecutor's hair.
It was really strange that the most important stuff started to come up later. Mm-hmm. You know, years later. And like you were saying, and so it sort of changed my mind as the information, you know, came out. I have no idea now if he was the murderer or not. There is a plausible kind of scenario where it was, as you suggested, drug related. You know, there's so much cocaine and drug sales going on in that neighborhood, which incidentally I was living in at the time. So mm-hmm. I'm quite familiar with this. I lived, I actually moved shortly before it happened, but I had been living on 4th Street in Santa Monica for years. And this is right down the road from Nicole's house, just a mm-hmm. 3-minute drive or something. So I know the area. It was nothing but cocaine at that time, and still is, actually. And even though it's kind of upscale, that area north of Wilshire is sort of an upscale part, but it's younger people. And so the drug, you know, culture had come in, and there was a lot of seedy characters, and there were lots of, violent events concerning drug sales. So that's, and given, as you say, the inability of the prosecutions to really, you have the blood evidence, but if that is taken out of their scenario, what do you have left? You know, you just have the fact that Simpson's has no alibi. Basically, right, and there was no hard evidence putting him at the site, and then there was the thing which I found out later on concerning the cut on his finger, which had been given as an example of, well, this indicates, you know, some kind of violent confrontation. Well, where was the cut on the glove?
Yeah.
You know? So that it all just, everything just seemed kind of unclear. It's not to say he didn't do it, but it didn't, at the end of it all, I didn't really feel that there was that strong a case against him.
And of course, being the defendant, he doesn't have to prove his innocence.
Right. And I think that both, lawyer teams did atrocious work. It just seemed that there was more kind of grandstanding for their career and book deals after the fact, you know. So it was a really pathetic experience in the United States, showing kind of the weakness of the legal system, and also the kind of moral decline of the country. The fact is O.J. had beaten up Nicole before. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was not contested. So you have an African-American athlete beating up his white wife, and then, you know, the murder occurring, and then he walks away. This obviously has cultural kind of implications. You know, people can take strong opinions one way or another about that. But it was just that there really wasn't good, forensic analysis done.
Seems to me you have like both white people and black people being triggered by the sensational aspect of the trial. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, and whether it's police brutality or police corruption, which is a legitimate issue, or exploitation of the race issue, and demonizing whites, which is also a legitimate issue. And so that's being used to obscure perhaps a bigger scandal. There's a Rampart scandal in L.A. The Los Angeles police department was implicated in gang activity and drug dealing. As you mentioned, the place is just filled with cocaine being sold all over the place. That invites violence. L.A. was a very violent place in the 80s. This is the early 90s, of course. And so little things like I read about his Bronco, which had been put into evidence that had been broken into twice, why impounded. Well, that's the police. They're not maintaining the chain of custody security of the evidence.
Exactly. The kind of head police chief, I think his name is Gates, big Freemason, connected into Hollywood. So who knows what goes on? It's a black box because, there's celebrity, there's, the political world of Los Angeles, which has to be kept secret from the public, of course. And so I just, at the end of it, it was just disgusting. I felt sorry for the victim and really don't know what happened, frankly. So,
I mean, if the murders were part of a drug run and a wider drug scandal, you can see the benefit of creating this sensationalist narrative and just saying, well, O.J. has money, he can defend himself, we'll just create this counter narrative. A very similar thing may have occurred with the Charles Manson murders of Sharon Tate, at 1969, where they spun this narrative of a satanic, him trying to spark a satanic race war, him loving the Beatles. None of that was true. he actually, if anything, he hung out with the Beach Boys, from what I understand, or a member of the Beach Boys. I mean, he was a drug dealer, a pimp. He was involved with the mob and stealing cars. He had some level of protection. And what happened there was, it appeared to be some sort of drug burn. It isn't to say that Satanism may not have been involved. It's Los Angeles for that, Hollywood. But to create a narrative that covers up a bigger scandal, because a lot of celebrities would have been drawn into that scandal if that narrative of Charles Manson and his gang trying to spark a race war. It's a sensationalist narrative, which covers up sort of a seedy element of the American establishment, which would be the entertainment industry out in L.A.
Exactly, and that's the thing that's kind of the phenomena that kind of connects both of these events, Manson and O.J.'s.
Because
you really have the world of the celebrity and the drug use by them and their control over the media as sort of a gigantic secret society. And the murders, you're given these scenarios which take you in one direction or another, but you never really can get that close to the truth because both the media and the police departments are compromised.
Yeah.
And that was really what I came away from. And, looking at Los Angeles, I mean, just as an example, look at the relationship between LAPD, CIA, and Freeway.
Ricky Ross, yeah.
Ricky Ross, you know, because this is where, you know, the introduction of crack cocaine into the African-American communities occurred. This was the, you know, ground zero. And that was all part of that world. I mean, the characters involved in that, you know, Jolly West, you know, who was a psychiatrist to celebrities. And, you know, he was at these parties with all of the A-listers. So suddenly, you know, it's just this one giant lump of malevolence, which you can't really penetrate because you don't have good journalism. You know, Gary Webb with Dark Alliance was probably the only good journalism that was done into any of this during that time. But it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I don't have any evidence, unfortunately. No one does. But I wouldn't be surprised if OJ and Manson, that all of that had been connected into the kind of secret society that runs Hollywood, which controls people through drugs and sex and blackmail and things like that. There's just, you really would need to have a better kind of focus of journalism, right, to be able to get to the bottom of any of this.
Well, how many like storied NFL owner families are tied to the mob? You know, like the 49ers owner, Bartolo family and all that.
Yeah.
Matt, you talk about, remember Michael Rupert?
Yeah.
He committed suicide like 10 years ago. But he claimed to be attempted to be recruited by the CIA to engage in drug dealing in LA. He's the one that confronted John Deutsch at that infamous town hall meeting.
Sure. That's right. Yeah, I saw the videotape of that. Yeah.
Now, again, this shows just how corrupt it was. Now, you know, a case like this, like the murder of two people who were apparently involved in drug dealing, Ron Goldman, confidential informant, apparently, that's telling. If he's a confidential informant, who's informing on another drug dealer? That could be a reason for the hit. And the idea that, yeah, this Arthur Riddick, 46-year-old former football player that wasn't in terrible shape then, that he was able to take out two younger adults without getting a scratch on his body is somewhat hard to believe. That said, it's also hard to believe that Ron, you know, that the two detectives would plant evidence knowing that O.J. Simpson would not have an alibi. So, we don't know. I mean, to do all that, to set up and know that O.J. wouldn't have an alibi,
If there was good forensic investigation, I think this thing could have been solved. There wasn't. And all we're left with now is kind of the kernels of truth that come out after the fact.
Yeah. Why wasn't there a good forensic investigation then?
Yeah. Because they didn't want
more government incompetence, or they just didn't want.
Right. I mean, why didn't they, you know, why wasn't someone trying to investigate Charles Manson's connections into the CIA? And why didn't anyone investigate Jolly West's connection into crack cocaine? I mean, LA is, you know, ruled by Hollywood, which is a, you know, key component of the secret society that rules the country. And the stories that you get are just the ones that create the best pretext for, you know, the political behavior in the future that they're trying to create. I mean, look at our current situation, you know, with these purported Hamas invasion of Israel, which was kind of a national suicide moment, you know, where they gave Israel exactly the pretext it needed to genocide them. Mm-hmm. You know, the situation, I think, in Iran right now is this is provoked by Israel's just insane destruction of the embassy, of the Iranian embassy in Syria. But what it looks to me like is that this is just a narrative. This is just they're trying to create a pretext to provoke Iran into some kind of reaction, from which they can then launch the kind of all-out attack and destroy military tech possibilities. You know?
The Biden administration telling Iran not to retaliate. Well, they were attacked.
Right. That's right.
Syria hasn't been at war with Israel since 1973, yet I think they bombed Syria weekly, Israel.
Yeah, they're just, it's just a
genocide. I mean, that's like, okay, this is normal. Susan Powers recently came, she testified that famine is breaking all over Gaza. She's treating like a weather event. Well, why is famine breaking out over Gaza? There's a hunger blockade. That's why. Who's imposing the blockade? And they're the ones that murdered 7 aid workers for the World Kitchen.
And you know, it's funny, like everything, OJ, Manson, it all kind of, there is this specter that hangs over all of this, you know, which is, we have this problem in the world, Tim, where a group is basically genocidal and feels that large swaths of humanity are subhuman and they can murder them.
Yeah, the Polish ambassador, I'm sorry, there was an Israeli ambassador, I saw this on Polish TV show, a news show, and if I got it right, I think I got it right, he claimed that Israel is not capable of committing a war crime, meaning it cannot.
Yeah,
what does that mean? Cannot commit a war crime?
Because of the Holocaust, which
so creates... it's a physical impossibility.
Yeah, I mean, it's semantical games. It's sort of like, you know, blacks cannot be racist.
Well, it's like Merrick Garland claiming that he cannot be guilty of religious bigotry. I mean, sticking the FBI on Catholics because he's a
Holocaust survivor.
Survivors. I mean,
these are just semantical tricks for mind control. Yeah. The blacks cannot be racist is the, you know, understanding of the term that racism is only possible vis-a-vis class. And since the blacks are a repressed class, they cannot meet the criteria of the word racism. Well, this is a brand new definition of the word. They simply changed the definition of the word. So now, they can avoid being charged being racist because that would slow down the narrative of the white racism and then therefore the destruction of the European culture, which is guilty of racism.
So yeah, racism is like anti-Semitism. As Rabbi Barclay tutored Candace Owens a couple of weeks ago, is that race, anti-Semitism and racism, if you will, are ever changing. The definition is ever changing because it changes through the ages. It changes to suit the political whoever's making the accusation.
it means whatever we want it to mean whenever we want it to mean that.
So we're in Alice in Wonderland world, aren't we?
Well, we're in a world where our media is controlled. And so you don't have anyone pushing back in the media sense, except for people in the independent media, because the mainstream media is part of the process by which words are changed and used for exactly the political purpose that the oligarchs want. So
as far as pushing back goes, Tucker, you see that interview with Tucker Carlson? He interviewed the Christian, the Palestinian Christian.
No, I didn't see that.
He's being called an anti-Semite for pointing out that Christians are suffering in the Holy Land. Members of Gaza's small Christian community were among thousands of civilians killed in the Palestinians' enclave as a result of Washington's support for Israel in its war with Hamas, a pastor from Bethlehem has told journalist Tucker Carlson. In an interview posted on X, formerly Twitter, or Twitter X, whatever you want to call it, by the former Fox News host, emphasis former Fox News host, on Tuesday, Reverend Munther Isaac of the Evangelical Lutheran Christian Church also criticized Christian leaders in the United States for failing to oppose the destruction in Gaza. One of the biggest problems we are facing right now is the deterioration of our Christian community numbers. Isaac told Carlson, people keep leaving because of the political reality. Life under a very harsh Israeli military occupation is difficult to bear, he explained. Palestinian Christians are probably disproportionately affected by all this because of our small numbers as a religious community. Anything that happens impacts us severely, the pastor said. Carlson agreed that it's consistent, but almost never a noted theme of American foreign policy that it's always Christians who suffer, recalling the massacre of Catholics in Vietnam, the complete devastation of ancient Christian community in Iraq. We've always had a very serious problem when it comes to American foreign policy, Isaac replied. He referred to an Israeli airstrike in an Orthodox church compound in Gaza last October, which resulted in the death of 18 civilians. Now, why bomb an Orthodox church? American Christian support to Christians is actually conditioned by where you stand on the political spectrum. If Christians were hit or targeted or persecuted by someone who's not an ally, then you will see an outrage. But because Israel is an ally to America, no one cares about Christians being targeted, Isaac stated. Carlson ended his interview with the pastor by issuing an appeal to the audience. If you wake up in the morning and decide that your Christian faith requires you to support a foreign government blowing up churches and killing Christians, I think you've lost the thread. And of course, the usual suspects, the controlled right wing, have condemned Carlson's interview. They called him an anti-Semite. He's just merely pointing out an obvious. I think before the 1940s, Palestine was 20% Christian, a sizable minority. Now it's less than 2% since the founding of Israel.
Yeah. You know? And And, you know, Christianity is the target of the Judeo-Masonic conspiracy, and it is being attacked everywhere. And when it is attacked, there's always a pretext, or it's just ignored. They don't mention that. For example, how many people even knew about this problem with the Palestinian Christians?
Mm-hmm.
So it should have been something in our purportedly Christian culture that was being given to the public as an element in the conflict to consider. No one's been talking about it. Zero, and no one has really been talking about the plight of the Palestinian Christians over the last 60 years. I mean, you mentioned it just now. I mean, that's like one of the very first times I've heard anyone talk about it,
mm-hmm.
Even though it's something that's very real. And and the reason it's not discussed is that the Israelis don't want to lose the mind control over the evangelical Christians here who are slavishly supporting Israel. So they don't want this to be something that's in the public eye. This goes back to what I was just saying. You're just dealing with controlled media. So the information you're being given are there to, basically confuse you. I was on this podcast this week, and we were talking about, well, how to think in this world where the media is controlled. And, I was pointing out that, the situation in Gaza is actually a pretty good example of really, what can be done analytically. And I just said, look, they are able to establish what they call a fact. They have the monitoring and the video of the Hamas invasion, and then they have an interview with someone who then states there was babies' heads being lopped or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And now this becomes a fact. It's presented as a fact, and it is referred to in defense of the Israeli invasion as these are the facts. So they establish these things as facts, and I would suggest that you just can't believe anything as a fact that comes out of the pixelated world. It's just not an analytic position that will ever lead you to the best understanding. What you have to do is look at, first of all, context. What can actually determine about the situation in terms of what has gone on in the past and what momentum there is, like Israeli destruction of the Palestinian ownership of Judea. This is a context that makes you understand, helps understand the present moment. But moreover, you've got to end up with something that's logical. When you have this breaching of the Israeli border technology 7 times, even though it's impenetrable, right? Well, this is not logical. It just doesn't make any sense. And you have to start developing your own kind of understanding of the phenomena, the invasion and the subsequent Israeli response, in terms of your own capacity to understand what's reasonable, because you may not come up with the truth. I mean, that's something we may not be able to achieve, but at least you'll be, looking at the world with kind of, in a way that will insist that there is some kind of logic to how your understanding operates. And moreover, by going through the process, you'll develop skepticism. You won't just believe the nonsense like the people do who believe that, Hamas invaded Israel and Israel is justified in wiping out the Palestinians.
Yeah, this is all part of cognitive infiltration that Cass Sunstein talked about.
It is, indeed, yeah.
A decade ago for the Obama administration. Now, the fact that someone working for the U.S. government would admit to that psychological warfare strategy, why are we putting up with that? Why should we have any governmental position? I think it was that comedy that may have kept him off, prevented him from being nominated to the Supreme Court because it was so controversial at the time. But now it's just accepted as normal. Of course, isn't he the husband of Samantha Powers?
I believe so.
Yeah, okay, so there you go. And she's the one that's, she's the one that practicing soft power. She flies to different countries and talks about human rights. And of course, human rights is sodomy and transgenderism and,
Sure.
Sex mutilation surgery for kids and all that, that's human rights and feminism undermine more traditional conservative societies like Hungary or Romania. That's her thing. She's the one that recently commented about the famine in Gaza, and someone asked, well, who's causing the famine? She didn't answer that question.
And she won't, you know, I saw an interview with Quentin Tarantino. It's on YouTube. People should look at it. It's very important. The interviewer is very, you know, alert. And he said, you know, Quentin, you know, you say that all this violence, this black on white violence and all of this violence you have in your films, that this is cathartic. But is that really, you know, real? I mean, isn't it possible that, you know, presentation of violence will promote violence? And Tarantino went ballistic and, you know, distracting. He got angry and he says, I'm not going to answer a question that makes me, you know, like a some kind of like a farm animal to you, that you're, you know, you're able to ask these questions. And but he couldn't even,
yeah,
you know, sort of address this obvious, you know, which is obviously true, that he's promoting violence and he's promoting black on white violence. That's the whole purpose of his movies. But when asked about it, he takes it sideways. Now, you know, and goes into this, he's angry at the interviewer for being a bad person and, you know, trying to put him on the spot. Well, you know, then there is no follow-up. The fact that Tarantino couldn't answer the question should then become part of like the media presentation of Tarantino and all of his filthy movies. But instead it just disappears. Instead, there isn't any follow-up because the mainstream media and the Google algorithms will then, you know, just evaporate this, and you won't have this as part of any kind of momentum to coming to a like an overall conclusion by the public about Tarantino's movies and what they actually are for. So, you know, this is just our world, you know, and they, with Powers flies around, and you know, she is, they're not there to try to uncover the truth or even to do anything other than just continue casting a spell over the minds of the world's population so that basically genocide can occur. I mean, this is our world, you know, we have to be aware of that.
Yeah, we see that with the sort of this psychological warfare, casting spells, lying, if you will, just openly lying, bold-faced lying to the public, boldly lying to the public about things, and it's to the point where the system is simply losing its legitimacy, any yeah. knowledge and credibility. We had this recent report come out regarding crime, how crime is being way underreported. Well, it's not being reported at all, and this is being cited as an improvement in the situation, the condition of the United States, by reduction in crime since 2021. Of course, we had the explosion of crime in 2020 during the summer of George Floyd and summer of love and the, you know, the mostly peaceful protests, huge spike in crime. And there was a depolicing, a relaxation. And also there tends to be a sort of a coincidence or coincides an explosion in crime whenever there's an increased interest in so-called civil rights. It happened in the 60s through the 90s. And then we saw it again. It ended a little, it improved in the 90s up in, and then in, after 2015, there's 2016, with the birth of Black Lives Matter, courtesy George Soros, we've seen an uptick in crime again. But now this independent group of law enforcement officials and analysts claim that violent crime rates are much higher than figures reported by the Federal Bureau of Investigation in its 2023 violent crime statistics. The Coalition for Law and Safety released its April 2024 report called Assessing America's Crime Crisis, Trends, Causes, and Consequences. Identified four potential causes for the increase in crime in the most major cities across the U.S. Depolicing, decarceration, deprosecution, and politicization of the criminal justice system. Because all of these things are, you know, like, I guess, on the agenda of Black Lives Matter and their supporters. The authors were Mark Morgan, who's a former assistant director of the FBI, and Sean Kennedy, an attorney for the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. He was a former commissioner of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection for Trump. But basically what they're saying is that up to a few years ago, close to 90% of all the major cities participated in collecting data for the FBI. Now it's down to like 60%. And major cities like Los Angeles and New York and Chicago are not participating. Well, that's going to put a dent in your crime.
Right. That'll reduce your crime rate.
And so basically, this is simply not being reported. And also, people who are victimized don't bother reporting. Like if you're in Los Angeles, I'm sorry, you're in Chicago or San Francisco, you may not even bother New York City. You may not even bother report crime, a mugging or a break-in or your house being robbed. Because what's the point? So if major cities like Atlanta, New York City, and Los Angeles, aren't reporting, but nevertheless, they're still seeing major spikes in gun violence, homicides, and other violent crimes. The situation hasn't improved, but nevertheless, the government cites this phony report, and everyone sees through it. Everyone knows the reality out there, and we're supposed to be comforted by the government's claims.
That's so important, is that people are beginning to understand that the facts, right, the fact that is presented, crime rate is down, murder rate is down. Well, people understand this is just propaganda, and this is diminishing returns. This is important because the public reaction is that, well, we just don't see this as real. Like in Los Angeles, they talk about, well, we have the murder rate down. It's nonsense. It's just how they report it, and so the public can understand that the FBI is just part of a propaganda device. And the particularly like black on white crime is dramatically underreported because it cuts against the propaganda narrative that they're trying to do now with the merging of the ethnicities into the, an ungovernable clump that, has no agency, can't really do anything against the oligarchs. So this process is going on and they don't want someone to, point out to like European Americans that, well, the crime rate is this high and, it's almost all black against you, because this would then, cut against the idea that they're trying to put into Americans that integration is this brave new world thing. We have an example of that today in Los Angeles and Venice, another place where I used to live, Venice, California. There was a vicious attack, the woman survived but was just mauled. And they have videotape of the individual, and they've blacked out, to use an expression, the face, and then won't mention the individual's ethnicity, in their description of the crime.
But you can tell by the demeanor and posture.
But you can just tell it's a black guy, and yet they can't say that because that would, upset the propaganda spell that they're trying to cast. So,
well, was it the subway system in San Francisco? There's two ladies talking. One was a either director of it or director of public relations for the transit system, and it said that it will no longer be releasing videotape of incidents on the public transportation because it tended to support racial stereotypes.
Right. And so
it tended to reflect realities, Richard.
This is great because this is so ludicrous, so obviously untrue, that the public can see through this. And then that then creates more skepticism toward the facts that the government is presenting to us as what is real. And what is implicit is that, well, the citizens, we have to get our own facts. We have to develop our own news, our own method of, seeing what reality is. And frankly, this then just increases the independent media, just gives us more strength. So when they do things as, like blacking out the face of the individual on like the TV news about the Venice attack, and will not give the person's ethnicity, it almost it backfires. It creates exactly the opposite effect that they would like to have. It makes people who are aware, more vividly aware. They know that this is part of the black on white crime phenomena we should be thinking about, and people on the fence, people who are like just starting to become aware, it just pushes them more in the direction of, the independent media. They see stuff like that, and they can see through this. Many of them can. They can see that they're just being subjected to propaganda. And then hopefully, they'll start to develop their own information sources, their own facts.
Another example of this, again, is sort of delusion or just lying to the public in hopes the public doesn't notice the reality all around him, is the Biden administration's reports or statements on the performance of the U.S. economy. So-called misery index, I think that was developed in the 1970s. It combines the unemployment rate with inflation rate. Both of these numbers are political numbers, of course, the unemployment rate and inflation rates. But nevertheless, we do know that inflation rates has always been understated in the United States. There are all types of tricks they do with statistics to underestimate it. Both Republican and Democrat administrations have done this. The misery index adds up the rate of employment and inflation. Now, the official misery index is improving in the past couple of years, but improvement isn't being reflected in Biden's polling numbers. So the public is aware that things aren't good because they're living the reality. But nevertheless, the Biden administration thinks they can issue these reports and garner some sort of electoral benefit from it. But when the reality isn't any better, basically, they've grossly understated inflation or mischaracterized it. They say the inflation is going down because it's no longer 10%. It's only 5%. Well, still going up. It's like compound interest. It just goes up. They also, the way they compile inflation, they take out the things like the cost of energy or food. Wait a second.
Yeah, it's just a propaganda.
How do you do that? You know,
it's just ridiculous. Yeah. It's good. The good thing is the public is becoming more and more aware of it. More independent websites like Zero Hedge, they just lampoon the government statistics. They just excoriate them. They just say, look, this is, they point out that they're so false that they can only have been generated to produce propaganda.
It's almost like the Soviet Union when they should.
We are in the Brezhnev era where, he would give a speech for like 5 hours. And at the end of it, the people would pretend to clap, it's just that we're in a dream state where we're just in this condition, Tim, where the lying is just too overt now for anyone to not recognize it. People can see it, and it's just going to get a lot worse because the economy is going to get worse. I mean, if you drive around LA, it's starting to have the feeling of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Retail is dying. There's so many stores that are available on the streets now that.
See what they did in San Francisco? They proposed a bill that would require any grocery store to before it closes to put a basically to announce a plan to provide an alternative grocery store.
Yeah, that's going to fix the problem. I mean,
Maybe you should clamp down on looting and shoplifting.
Yeah, I mean, this is just ridiculous. And I mean, these poor little grocery stores, they're completely dead broke. How are they going to, if they couldn't even stay open, how are they going to guarantee the emergence of some, miraculous new store to replace them? It's just ridiculous. It's what they're really trying to do is to freeze them in place and make them stay open.
When you're making a brave new world, Joe, you can't worry about mundane economics.
I guess you can't. And
keeping the water running, you can't do.
You can see that. I mean, I hate to keep using the expression, but this is really diminishing returns because this isn't gonna fool anybody. I mean, what is real is they cannot talk about the effects of incarceration.
I'm an ideologue. I don't want to be bothered with something grubby like commerce.
Yeah, exactly. They cannot talk about the real effects of the incarceration and all of the social policies that promote violence, deliberately promote violence. They don't want to go into a discussion of that because this would just cuts against the propaganda narrative, which is leading us into the brave new world of our genocide.
Well, they say something like decarceration. It says that the problem is that prisons are too full of black men. Well, that is a problem, I guess you could say. Way of coping with that problem is incarcerating those black men who are committing crime. The solution isn't to empty the jails. The jails that are full of criminals are a symptom. They're a reaction to a problem. There's another problem you have to address. And of course, that doesn't get addressed if your paradigm or your worldview is evil white guy, the white devil, and the angelic poor black victim. It's
right. I get quite a bit of emails about the comments I made a few weeks ago concerning the archaic hominin, which the ghost species that they've discovered in sub-Saharan West Africa. Mm-hmm. That makes up an enormous percentage of the the genes of mm-hmm. Any clear-minded, kind of civil servant in this process, should ask the question of, are we dealing with, a problem that could have genetic basis? Because if we had an honest discussion, then you could have honest solutions to it, right? You'd have some way of actually helping these people and also protecting the people who have been being victimized, if these things in fact have this some kind of genetic.
If there weren't differences, cognitive differences, I know it muddies water because not everyone's a pure race or ethnicity, but nevertheless, in the broader picture, it's there. If there aren't these cognitive differences among different ethnic groups or racial groups, how come all efforts at diversity across the board all require across the board reduction of academic standards or production standards or performance standards? Why is that the case?
Good. That's a good question.
In order to meet that quota, why do you have to drastically reduce standards?
Yeah, and
why is it like public schools? I was listening to an article that says, here's the problem. It sounds nice. You can just treat people equally and fairly and just pass these laws and then everyone's going to be happy. Well, it's a bit more complicated than that because the narrative you spun is just simply isn't true. They do polling. They say, well, Black people want to have nice houses and good schools and orderly communities too, just like white people. They both want the same thing. Well, of course, you phrase it in that question, everyone's going to want it, but what does it take to achieve that? It takes basically you have to, when you send your kids to school, the kids have to understand discipline and a proper authority and behave properly. But Blacks as a group in general aren't willing to impose the discipline or maintain the family units or integrity that educates the kids properly. They want to live a certain way. Public orderly streets, clean streets. You have to make effort to maintain those things. If you don't want to live a certain way, if your idea is hanging out in the middle of the street, getting drunk in the middle of the street, or not picking up your trash, you may want nice neighborhoods. You're not going to get nice neighborhoods. If you don't impose discipline standards on your children, you want good schools, but you're not going to get good schools. You want to be able to have good jobs. Everyone wants good, high paying jobs, but you're not willing to put in the time and training or academic performance or learning. You may not even be fully capable of it. You're not going to get those things. And that's just a harsh reality. Wanting these things isn't the same as doing what it takes to get those things. Everywhere you see, from Jackson, Mississippi to Baltimore to Chicago, they don't want them bad enough to do what it takes to achieve those things. The problem is they think everything grows on trees. You can just pick it off and it exists, or it doesn't. What you learn rapidly is you start picking things off, the stores go away. And the job and the employment opportunities and the purchasing opportunities go away, and you have food deserts. And then what's the explanation? Racism.
Right. I mean, they have been, African Americans have been placed under a spell. I mean, this is, I think, clear. And since I'm so old, 75 in a few days, so I mean, I'm really ancient at this point. I can tell you that in the late 50s and early 60s, the African American culture was moving in a really positive direction for them and for society in general. Now, what happened? They were deliberately attacked, and the attack was successful. So now you have an end of the Black family. Obviously, this was done deliberately because the programs that were implemented with Great Society, called the Great Society, all of the demographic statistics did U-turns. So they could see that, this was the result of the Great Society. So what you end up with now is the most vulnerable group. So in other words, say that, you look honestly into the genetics of the different ethnicities and you go, there are these things inside the West, sub-Saharan West Africans, which make it more difficult for them, for example, to be patient, just say as an example. Say they have this. Well,
there's a genetic basis for temperament. Yeah.
Right. So say this is correct. And okay, so now you say, okay, well, it's sad. But it's a material fact. What are you going to do about it? If you had the honest discussion, Tim, then the last thing you would do would say, well, let's have a social policy where we get rid of the father, because we really want to promote.
Exactly.
Well, wait a second. If these people in fact are making progress, and are doing so in the auspice of developing more and more families, more, the fathers have real jobs. I mean, if these these things are not on par with European Americans, but they're certainly moving in a direction that is going correct and everyone is benefiting from it. Why would you change that? You see, I would argue that it's because they were becoming, the African Americans were becoming successful in America, that they were attacked. That's one of the reasons why they hit them with the Great Society program, because they wanted to create the pimp and hoe culture. And as an example of that, look at the when we had this like Black Wall Street in Oklahoma was set up, and the attack on it, the destruction of it, was Freemasonic, right? This is where the attack on that community came from. So I think it's that the Great Society is an example of, they want chaos, they want violence, because this is the pretext for their taking more and more power, right? They have more and more power, the more violence, the more chaos there is in the streets. And they attacked the African-American because they knew he was fragile. They knew that for many reasons, perhaps some, and I'm almost certain some are genetic, but others were just the fact that they were actually brought here as slaves, which couldn't have been very good for their culture. So it's just self-evident. So they were vulnerable. And that's why they were the ones that were hit with the Great Society programs, which were designed to wreck their culture. Now we have, as white Americans, we look out at the chaos and the violence, and our response is, well, you know, we have to separate ourselves from them, which is a coherent response, but also that we see them as, you know, bad, as inferior, as dangerous, you know, kind of, it's the racism, you know, and except one in which a lot of people feel that they're justified in expressing. But the fact is, in doing so, we're just falling right into the, you know, into the trap that was.
Well, their problem is that their demands, their claims of being victims of white racism coincide with their constant demands for having proximity to whites.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because they've been told that this is how, you know, that they had proximity to us, that this will solve some of their problems.
I understand. It's damaging to one's pride. To these things, and that's where they're exploited. I mean, I would say the civil rights movement was largely was an attempt by the WASP, then the Jews. It was a WASP Jewish alliance to agitate blacks, to particularly go after Catholic neighborhoods in the North. And there was a weaponized migration and a social engineering process that was given the color of progressive civil rights and humanitarian concerns. And obviously there are issues to exploit. But again, that's one of the things where people don't bother. They just simply swallow the government and the government's narrative on this. And then there you are. And so this is where, again, that's one thing. People don't know the hidden grammar to these things. It was psychological warfare. And that's why things have just gotten worse and things never get better with race relations, even as material conditions improve. In fact, if anything, race relations tended to get worse as material conditions improve. That's sort of the revolution of rising expectations, if you will. It's a phenomenon that's often observed.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting in the Fannie Willis debacle, you could really see how the minds of the African-Americans, of Fannie and of her boyfriend, how destroyed their minds were. That by the propaganda, they felt justified in doing whatever they wanted to do to feather their nest. This is a general statement here, that they didn't feel there was any problem with graft, corruption, with using federal money for swag, you know, buying things from
people. Yeah, she admits it under oath.
Right. Because well, we're blacks, and this is just how we're able to get ahead. And my point is, the moral structure, right, of the world and of their selves had been taken out. They had no moral structure at all.
Yeah, the only way to get ahead is to plunder.
Yeah, and it isn't plunder because this is just how you get ahead. And because you get ahead, it isn't immoral.
And we got it coming.
Yeah,
as an empowered woman of color, I have to do this and that.
There is no self-consciousness on her part that she was kind of engaging in not just evil activity, but activity that really was going to keep her in an inferior place, because she wasn't really deserving anything that she was getting. It's all just being given to her.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
And so this the skills that she could have been developing, you know, to get ahead and also to have some kind of, you know, intelligence that she could defend herself against propaganda with, it just isn't there. That woman is a really good example.
Yeah, she'd be better off being an honest cafeteria worker than a corrupt,
100%
incompetent lawyer. It's obviously what she is.
Her soul would flourish under that. She would have reality, yeah. You know, but now in this dream world, in the spell, there isn't any moral basis to it. And, you know, this trick has been applied to Europeans as well as African-Americans. It's why before you have the real destruction of European culture, you often have pornography introduced, right? Like in Germany, you know, they did in leading up to, you know, into World War II.
Yeah, and right after too, right?
When they right after, because they're trying to take away the moral underpinnings. You know, the thing is that what people don't understand, people think of morality as, you know, something to do with religion, and it does, but it also has to do with just having a real civilization. Without sexual restraint, you don't have family.
Well, civilization requires deferred gratification in all deferred things.
Deferred gratification and the acceptance of certain rules that are necessary so they can have commerce.
Yeah.
When you're told that, you know, take all the swag you want because you're, you know, from a disadvantaged group, well, you're not heading towards civilization. It's just the opposite. You're heading because that's only going to work for a while.
Well, then this is why usury and sodomy are so destructive, because it undermines the ability for deferred gratification. I want something now, I'll pay for it later. Well, that comes with a huge cost. You know, and same with not being able to control, you know, and not being able to keep your pants.
And that's why pornography is literally a black hole that will swallow civilization if it isn't checked. You know, I was
I'll charge my subscription to Playboy on my credit card.
I was pointed out that there was two women sociologists that presented a paper, and they were shocked in analyzing the sexual behavior of young people, people under 20. And they found that there was this trend that had been established and that many of the girls were complaining about, where in the sex act, men are now choking women. It's just very, very common.
Okay.
In fact, in the paper, they were saying that like up to 40% of them had experienced this.
A social contagion where it's being picked up on the internet or something? Or?
You know, what I would suspect is it's because the males have learned about sexuality through pornography. Pornography, S&M is used to, you know, as to heighten the
violence, you know, and sex. That's why you have an art.
You see, here you really see how pornography is affecting culture. That is not behavior that would occur in the 50s, 60s, or 70s. And when 30, 40%, I mean, it was an incredibly large number of young girls they were saying that it frightened them. They were afraid. They didn't know how to say no. And they didn't understand why it was being done. It's because the minds of these males who are having, you know, having the sex with them have been polluted through pornography. This is where, obviously, now this is, I think it's important, because this is like one of the first examples I think the public can understand, that you have all of this pornography, right? And it's, no one is doing anything about this, right, Tim? I mean, it's just the internet, half of its usage is males watching pornography, you know, mm-hmm. Some of the studies I've seen. And this just goes on. No one is complaining about it. Nothing is being done. It's freedom of speech, First Amendment.
You know? Yeah, First Amendment, yeah.
But you see, anyone who looks at this clearly and honestly would say, no, this is going to ruin the sexuality of these men. It's going to ruin them. This has to be stopped. Well, finally, this has been the first one there's been other papers, but this one I think is the easiest to understand. Where here you have the behavior of the men has really been catastrophically affected, negatively affected by their exposure to pornography. So one hopes that the public will recognize this and start to, they ban us. They ban our show on all of these channels, right? Papers where I get, you know, correspondence from Facebook saying, you know, you violate the community standards. And I kind of like laugh, because I go, gee, you know, here's an analytic piece. that's, you know, has facts and reasoning. You know, it could be wrong, but at least I'm trying to be honest and using, you know, best I can. Should be easy to refute. You don't have to censor me. But instead, they do. And then pornography just rolls on with no contest, you know.
Yeah. It's sort of the, but they promoted all this deviant stuff and it's become normalized.
Yeah.
They started with homosexuality. Well, probably started with feminism and homosexuality and then transgenderism. And here, just think this case up in Canada where a young man had his fingers, two fingers removed because he suffered body integrity dysphoria. And they're saying, well, yes, because now he can feel complete without his two fingers. What?
Yeah. The medical profession has been compromised.
We
saw it during COVID, and now here's another example. The whole transgender social push could never occur if the medical community had not been compromised and taken over. I mean, look, this goes. Remember when the Rockefellers took over?
The point is that this body integrity dysphoria is just a continuation of transgenderism.
Of course, it is.
You know, and now people, there's going to be like people who identify as amputees demanding that they be respected. Maybe Christmas will become body integrity. You know, what do you call these people? What would be a positive term for these people?
Give me a second. I don't know. You know, but
Christmas Day will be a visibility day.
Yeah. And they could have their lost limbs, pictures of them, like a relative thing, you know, so yeah. It's where it goes because.
Well, my point is that they're claiming as if this is an actual thing. I say this is a social contagion that's sparked by promotion in the media, by the various foundations that we've talked about, mostly Jewish and families that fund this stuff, the promotion in the media. That's why it's a social contagion, because the people who control the media are constantly talking about it, and they're bought and paid for politicians are backing it up with things like the Equality Act, which would force everyone to indulge in everyone's delusion, these people's delusions about being the opposite sex, you know, they really are, being transgenderism. You have to accept their delusion. And the mental illness, they say this causes, basically, if you don't accept them, it creates mental illness. No, the fact that they're already claiming to be something they're not means they're mentally ill. And indulging in mental illness is not a solution to such mental illness. At the same time, the very system, like, passing laws like the Equality Act and doing research and having programs in schools that encourage behavior is increasing the mental illness. That isn't adding to it. It's giving these people a cachet and influence that they would ever have outside being patronized by these billionaire families that are obviously doing this to sow even more confusion, more moral confusion, and more subvert society even more. And it's obvious.
Absolutely. And you know, last week that British pediatrician, Dr. Cass, Hillary Cass, she organized a paper which was, you know, very kind of tidy and sort of necessary to be done, not too difficult. She just went through all of the people who were claiming that they were, gender fluid, and she determined that they overwhelmingly have other mental health issues. Yeah. And that, so it's not real gender dysphoria that you're dealing with. It is the mental illness. And she also points out with something that we mentioned before, that an incredible percentage of them are actually so-called neurodiverse. In other words, they're autistic.
Yeah, which is another, and what causes that?
Exactly. And so she pointed out that the gender-affirming medical intervention, her study clearly shows, basically, it turns a blind eye to the actual underlying psychological illness, which in our present controlled social moment is then categorized by the psychiatrist as a gender dysphoria requiring, you know, hormone therapy.
Yes,
things like that.
Very expensive treatment and drugs or drug regimen your entire life after, you know, post-operation.
Right.
Because you have to physically maintain the delusion.
Yeah.
Basically, like if you're a man transitioning to a so-called transitioning to a woman, the wound they create cannot heal. About that.
No, it can never heal.
How perverse that is.
But anyway, so I was really happy to see this because remember during the COVID debacle, where just a few sort of, you know, like doctors would come forward and contradict mainstream narrative.
Yeah.
They became very popular in within the public. And actually, like, well, RFK Jr. Became sort of the heroes and the survivors of the event and started changing the behavior of the public. Now, I mean, who's taking boosters at this point, you know?
Yeah.
So the thing is, when you see this, hopefully now this will embolden other, you know, medical researchers to follow up with more studies, just proving the obvious. And what's important is that then, you know, this voice, this opposition to, you know, the transgender movement can become just more acceptable and more popular. And then hopefully we can turn it around and destroy it like we did with the, you know, with the vaccine cult, you know, that they tried to hoist on us with COVID.
Yeah. In Scotland, they passed a hate crime and public order act, which makes it a felony to stir up hatred. Basically, it makes it a crime to stir up hatred. The ambiguous language relating to age, disability, religion, sexual orientation, transgender identity, or being intersex. Basically, hatred being criticism. In response to this hate crime law, the J.K. Rowling, of course, Harry Potter author, posted a statement of fundamental truth. She wrote, "In passing the Scottish Hate Crime Act, Scottish lawmakers seem to have placed higher value on the feelings of men performing their idea of femaleness, however misogynistically or opportunistically, than on the rights and freedoms of actual women and girls. For several years now, Scottish women have been pressured by their government and members of the police force to deny the evidence of their eyes and ears, repudiate biological facts, and embrace a neo-religious concept of a gender that is unprovable and untestable. The new legislation is wide open to abuse by activists who wish to silence those of us speaking out about the dangers of eliminating women's and girls' single-sex spaces. The nonsense made of the crime data if violent and sexual assaults committed by men are recorded as female crimes. The grotesque unfairness of allowing males to compete in female sports. The injustice of women's jobs, honors, and opportunities are being taken by trans-identified men. And the reality and immutability of biological sex. The redefinition of a woman to include every man who declares himself one has already had a serious consequence for women's and girls' rights and safety in Scotland, with the strongest impact felt as ever by the most vulnerable, including female prisoners and rape survivors. Rowling tests the law by listing 10 trans women, in quotes, including a convicted rapist, sex abusers, and high-profile activists on X, and stating that they were men. Rowling declared that freedom of speech and belief was at the end was at end if the accurate description of biological sex was outlawed. If what I've written here qualifies as an offense under the terms of the new act, I look forward to being arrested when I return to the birthplace of my Scottish enlightenment." To the birthplace of Scottish enlightenment, Rowling said. She added Twitter hashtag arrest me. I like it good, but it's not just a freedom of speech. Basically, what they're saying is this is a war on reality.
Yes.
Basically, yes. What they're saying is that those who are in power have a right to determine what truth is. Truth is the opinion of the powerful here, because they're saying you have to believe this. The idea is there is truth, regardless of your station life, regardless who's saying it, and we're all held accountable to it. And that's what's important, being able to all agree on a notion of reality here. They are ambitious. And once they destroy the concept of reality, they're able to tell us that we have to say 2 + 2 = 5, that a man is a woman and a woman is a man. That's what's really at war here. It's a war on reality here, which is basically directly to totalitarianism under the guise of human rights and tolerance. If you tolerate insanity, you're going to have an insane society and order falls apart and nothing works.
Right. And then, of course, you have to have a gigantic federal government to control the mess, which is what they're intending. I was just going to point out that the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics this week announced that it would not permit transgender men competing in women athletic events. So it's a small organization. I don't know, a couple hundred schools, you know, private schools in it, but at least they took the stance. And so when an option is available like this, then these schools will flourish, right? Parents will send their children them because they can see this is where reality is respected. And so then the schools that are, you know, kind of towing the mainstream insane line, like, you know, Harvard, Yale, these schools will start to diminish.
Don't participate with them.
Don't participate in them. Don't send your kid there. Don't fund them. So this is what, you know, is what else can the public do? The government is a you know, a secret society organized against us. And I wanted to digress. I'll just point out, I was watching a debate on whether or not the moon landing had actually occurred, right? And the opponent of the thesis said that no, it had definitely occurred, because if it hadn't, the Russians would have shown us that it hadn't. They would have complained, right? Because they would want, you know, they were in the space race, and therefore, you know, they would have said, no, we can tell this is fake, and you know, they would have made some use of it. And you know, I realized that the guy who was making the claim was just, he doesn't understand the logic of the argument, because the fact is that if it is true, if the space, you know, if the moon landing didn't occur, of course Russia would be in on the deal. You couldn't do it any other way. And see, what it does is, it's sort of like 9-1-1. It shows that the government is not what you think it is. This is what the reality, you know, that you get from the fact. So if the rules of physics and all the evidence showed that the moon landing didn't occur, you bloody well would better come to the understanding it isn't just that rot, that society doesn't just exist inside America. It has to be in many other governments, right? Otherwise, it would be exposed. But the fact that it's not doesn't mean that we landed on the moon. It just means that we have to re-understand what is the ruling class on the planet. You know, that's what we need to do.
Well, there was a Russian scientist at the time was asked, or some at some time was asked, why didn't the Soviet Union ever put a man on the moon? And his response was, we don't have Hollywood.
Yeah, right. So there it is. You know? So anyway, but my point is that you have to completely rethink your understanding of government when you see events that are profound and are also impossible. Things that are like the moon landing and, you know, why we haven't been back. And 9-1-1, of course, is the classic where, you know, the building falls straight down. It's not possible. Rules of physics are, you know, just negate this as having been anything other than
a control. How about the fact that the federal government, U.S., the White House is celebrating Transvisibility Day on Easter Sunday?
Well, there you have it. Right? So all of this, right. So the government is not what it tells you it is. And yeah. And your understanding, therefore, was wrong. And therefore, you have to also realize, well, maybe my understanding of the Russian government is wrong as well.
Yes.
You see, you can't just, you know, it's called, you know, counterfactual speculation. Once the facts contradict, you know, the moon landing and the U.S. government's presentation of it, you have to then say, well, you know, you can't trust any of these governments, you know. So this is the thing, is that... Hopefully the transgender push is so obviously destructive and anti, you know, realism, that it'll just accelerate the understanding of government as a secret society and the public's trying to organize against it. And my pointer is just, it actually is diminishing returns. They put out stuff this absurd. It was just like COVID and the vaccine mandates. It ends up with more of the public is skeptical, not less.
Yep. And again, when you're questioning a government narrative or an official narrative or a regime narrative, if you will, they're the ones providing the narrative and they have to prove it. You doubting it don't have to prove it wrong. You just have to point out various inconsistencies exactly. In it and say, I'm just asking these questions, as Tucker Carlson said on his interview regarding Israel and the Holy Land and the treatment of Christians.
There's something that is logical in your propaganda against us. You can't just say, well, Hamas invaded Israel because they thought they could defeat it. Well, or they didn't think Israel would counterattack and wipe out the Palestinian population. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. It's not logical. It's not real. So if you're gonna you know, give us propaganda, we're gonna make sure at least it is actually, you know, kind of rational. It's not inexplicable, like the explanation they gave, you know, for what happened with the October 7th invasion of Israel by Hamas.
Well, okay, Joe, I think we covered it.
Yeah, we did. It was fun, Tim. Thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
Take care.
All right, brother. Bye bye.
Bye bye.